From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Vanessa Gregoriadis spent 3 years listening to college kids talk about sex and sexual assault. And some of what she was hearing was loud and clear. Stories of women in vulnerable positions being exploited and abused. And she is convinced sexual assault is rampant on campuses throughout the country. But what she also found was something more complicated. Not just good and evil, though there is that, but something in the middle, what she calls the mushy middle. College, she says, is a strange planet. And she's written a book that explores this new culture, how sex and consent works or doesn't on campus. She'll join us today to talk about it. Her book is called Blurred Lines. After the news.
Support for this Radio West podcast comes from Primary Children's Hospital. They've been recognized by U.S. News and World Reports for care in all 10 pediatric specialties, including cardiology, orthopedics, neurology, and cancer treatment. Primary Children's Hospital, the child first and always.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The reporter Vanessa Gregoriadis says we're not really going to be able to do something about sexual assault on college campuses until we learn to talk about sex itself and the way these post-adolescent kids, basically, you know, college students, are having sex and trying to figure out the rules of consent. Sexuality on campus has always been dynamic, but it's particularly complicated today. You have social media where students are pressured to create these sexual identities. You have feminist activism on one hand, masculine traditions on the other. And all of this is further complicated by the unrealistic images of pornography and a culture of binge drinking. Gregoriadis has written a book where she attempts to move the conversation forward, and she's joining us today to talk about it. The book is called Blurred Lines, Rethinking Sex, Power, and Consent on Campus. Gregoriadis is a long-form journalist who focuses on pop culture and youth movements. She's a contributing editor at the New York Times Magazine and Vanity Fair. She joined us from a studio in New York City. The original title of the book was going to be Sex Ed, Heroism, Evil, and the Parameters of Consent. So I'm interested in what you were thinking about originally, because you talk about how as you started to dig into this, you figured the idea behind that original title wasn't really the story you thought you could tell. Start there, if you would.
Sure. So, yes, indeed, that was the original title. And I do reveal that in the book to make the point that, you know, certainly there are rapists in the world. There are dyed-in-wool serial predators who are, you know, unconscionably evil. But much more often on campus, what you're seeing is a lot of early formative sexual experiences, because college is where that happens for most Americans. And those experiences include non-consensual experiences. So not just, oh, fumbling, weird, awkward sex, but truly assaultive, I'm not going to let you get away till I can have sex with you and coerce you and pressure you verbally or maybe emotionally or even just pull somebody back on the bed or, you know, kind of pin you down a little bit, kind of things that are happening, particularly in college where there's, you know, very little supervision. A lot of people who don't have a lot of responsibilities. I'm talking particularly about residential colleges.
Yep, of course. Yep.
And a lot of time on their hands.
And they're still adolescents, as you point out in the book.
Right. They're still adolescents. So they're at an age where they're exploring and they're also feeling a lot of strong emotions. You know, they are kind of, you know, you've guys who are sending 200 texts a day to a girl that he likes, not realizing, you know, that that is a real kind of, you know, just a violation of her boundaries, right? That's way beyond just, oh, I'm flirting and I'm coming on to you and this is what guys do. Like, that's entering, you know, real creep zone. Mm-hmm. So a lot of my book is about that thing, which is The line between consent and non-consent and how a new generation is defining it.
Yeah. It seems like on one hand you have, which, and you lay this out and we'll talk about it, sometimes the, what I guess could be described as the kind of excessive language of some young activists on one hand. Mm-hmm. And then on the other hand, you have people like Candace Jackson who say, and others who are skeptical of some of these sexual assault claims, who say that they're bogus and it's not really happening. So you have those two extremes. And one of the things you point out early in the book is for the rest of us trying to figure what's really happening, it's incredibly confusing.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I mean, that's why I called this book Blurred Lines, because it's about kind of rethinking all of these blurry lines and figuring out how do we make a straight line between consensual and non-consensual. You know, how do we use our definitions wisely? Because right now, it is clear that the problem that exists on campus is not necessarily one of Candace Jackson saying, girls are simply not really telling the truth here and boys are being expelled from campus left and right. And it's not what the young progressive, as they like to call them, social justice warriors are saying, which is, you know, every man is a rapist and you've got to watch out and watch your back. And this happens to every single woman. Because if you have your definitions clear, it really doesn't happen to every single woman, you know. The truth is that they are just not dealing with the fact that there's a new standard of consent that many young people want, that universities are trying to foster in young people. And, you know, I argue for this in this book because to me it's about a standard of ethical sex and compassionate sex and treating partners thoughtfully, much of which, you know, seems like it should be second nature. But at the same time, like, you know, the way that people are having these early formative experiences on campus are not that cool. Like they are hookups. Yeah. They are one night stands. They are, you know, people who don't know each other very well, a lot of times enabled by massive amounts of alcohol. And we need some rules around them. They have – those encounters have gotten too messy, blurry, whatever you want to call them. There should be some rules on them.
It's, do you feel like you have to keep going back to this disclaimer that you make about – and which you make very clear and throughout the book – that it is a proven phenomenon that sexual assault is rampant on college campuses. So you're not calling that into question. What you're trying to do is just move the conversation forward.
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, look, I wrote this book before all of the news breaks around, you know, I guess Bill O'Reilly being cast out of Fox was the last story that broke before I finished the book. Now we have, you know, not only Harvey Weinstein, but, you know, a plethora of guys throughout Hollywood and in elite media circles and many famous women standing up to say that these things were done to them. I think that, you know, we have some pretty problematic survey data from surveys over the years on college campuses. Sometimes, you know, not enough people are surveyed. Sometimes it's only people who choose to take the survey, which gives you a kind of skewed sample group because most people who, you know, will choose to take a survey about sexual assault victimization may also be sexual assault victims and they're interested in the topic. There are problems, but still consistently over time, there are like dozens and dozens of studies using different kinds of criteria that are showing that a lot of people on college campuses are ticking that box, that they have been sexually assaulted. And, you know, whether that means that they've had the exact experience of a Harvey Weinstein where you really have somebody who is a compulsive predator, I don't believe that that's what you're finding on college campuses. What you're finding is a lot of guys who've just been kind of socialized in American masculinity that yeah. says, like, push girls as hard as you can because into sex, because even if you get a no at first, you know, you'll get a yes by the end. And, you know, this is the way a real man has sex.
Yeah. And they're being educated by pornography in some cases, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sure. Like, they, you know, it seems baffling to me that there's not, like, a national outcry over the effect of pornography yeah. on youth sex. Like, I mean, it's so commonsensical to me that these two things must be related, like, particularly in parts of the country where there's not that much sex ed.
Yeah.
Or the sex ed that it exists is kind of like, this is what birth control is, or this is what an STD is. You know, people are learning how to have sex from pornography, which is often very, very debasing for yeah. women, and slightly violent. Not like, you know, that everybody's sitting around watching very violent porn, but these kind of low-level acts of violence, like hair pulling, yeah. spanking, slapping, that's all very available in really any porn that, you know, is kind of mainstreamed. So, you know, I think there needs to be much more attention paid to the kind of culture we're creating and the messages that yeah. we're allowing to filter into our young people's minds.
Yeah, I think we'll come back to that in a moment. I wanted to ask you about reporting this. Over the course of some 3 years, it expands on some of your previous reporting, of course. You talked to more than 120 students, 20 different mm-hmm. universities, 80 administrators and experts. And I wanted to ask you, you've described yourself as a Gen Xer with a husband and a mortgage and a toddler,
mm-hmm.
but looking young enough to blend in on campus. And I wonder, did you think of yourself as trying to kind of, on some level, embed yourself in that mm-hmm. culture?
Sure. I mean, I, you know, have been a magazine writer for many years, particularly writing for Rolling Stone and Vanity Fair and the yeah. New York Times, like New York Magazine, all of these magazines where, you know, you use a bit of a subjective attitude and subjective voice towards your subjects. So you, you know, really try to get the story beyond the story. And so I applied those same tools to this kind of reporting. You know, I mean, I'm not going to go to universities and ask the communications department for an interview with some students, right? I'm just yeah. going to show up.
Right.
College yeah. campus is a pretty friendly place for a journalist, right? Because, you know, it's porous. You just walk on and students are excited to talk to you. I used a lot of first names of students to try to, you know, this generation, they love to kind of share and love to speak with their real names, and they don't want pseudonyms necessarily. But, you know, in some cases I felt like, okay, I'm just going to use a first name of this person
yeah.
because they don't need to have their full name. And they're kind of able to make that decision on their own, but they're also like 19 years old.
Right.
You know, I do have some responsibility.
Yeah.
They're talking about very intimate things. So I just put a backpack on and, you know, I kind of wear sneakers and jeans anyway in my daily life. And, you know, was just like the weird older sister in the corner
who was
trying to observe things at this frat party. I mean, it was a truly strange experience. But I do look, you know, much younger than my age, thankfully. Thank God. And kind of dressed down
yeah.
a bit more than normal and, you know, went to the dorms and talked to the kids and sat cross-legged on a floor and, like, ate the gross microwaved quesadillas and, you know,
yeah.
I
yeah.
mean,
yeah.
I didn't drink with any of them. I felt that that would be too, you know,
too
really a bridge too far.
Yeah.
But I, you know, certainly kind of hung out and really came out of this with you know, a sense that we need to fix this problem for sure, this sex and sexual assault problem. But also, like, the kids are all right.
Yeah.
Like, they're very verbal. They're very articulate. They're very fun. A lot of them have their heads screwed on straight. You know, you have this impression, like, as a parent, like, oh, my God, all these teenagers just with their phones. A lot of these kids never even took their phones out when they were talking to me, partially because it was like, oh, an adult is here interested in my life.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I mean, this is serious, you know. But, like, they weren't, like, little zombies on their phones. They're kids who are, like, genuinely interacting with the world and thinking seriously about a lot of topics. And particularly, you know, politics. I mean, this is a moment like 1969 where any kid, you know, with a brain is, you know, forming a political opinion, discussing it with their friends, engaged with the world in a way that, quite honestly, I wasn't 20 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, I read Moby Dick and I was in, you know, a David Mamet play and, you know, then I hung out with my friends and thought about nothing,
yeah,
basically, or just like our own like little clicky things that we were talking and thinking about and music or, you know, it's almost like music, which was so important to so many different generations, has been superseded by this political kind of, you know, focus,
yeah,
and need to be in this political conversation.
It's Vanessa Gregoriadis. Her book is called Blurred Lines, Rethinking Sex, Power, and Consent on Campus. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with the journalist Vanessa Gregoriadis about her new book, which is an exhaustive exploration of sex and sexual violence on college campuses around the country. The book is called Blurred Lines, Rethinking Sex, Power, and Consent on Campus. So one of the stories, there are a lot of stories, of course, in here. One of the stories you use to illustrate all of this is Emma Sulkowicz. You met with her, this is in August of 2014, and she told you about her plan that I'm sure people will know about, her plan to carry a mattress around the campus every day until the school expelled this person, she said, who had sexually assaulted her. Talk a little bit about this story, which you kind of bookend your book with, mm-hmm, and why this is kind of emblematic of what you were trying to convey.
Yeah. So, I mean, this was the initial story that got me working on this topic. You know, New York Magazine sent me up to Columbia's campus in Upper Manhattan to interview all the students who were involved in the sexual assault issue there. And I met Emma. This was before she even started carrying her mattress. And, you know, she was one of multiple people that I thought would be interesting to portray, and she was said that she was a victim of sexual assault by another classmate, and she and her friends were like the brand of person I was just talking about. They were so smart,
yeah,
and articulate and so thoughtful and really stubborn, you know, really looking at this thing that they felt that they had suffered and saying, we need the world to change,
right?
Like, we are going to change it, and we're a new generation, and we're optimistic about the change that we can make. But, you know, the time is now. And so I found them to be really totally, just mesmerizing and very charismatic. And Emma, when she began carrying this mattress around, I mean, which is – it's so crazy. But the world that we live in, you know, these kind of viral memes just take off,
yeah,
and suddenly the entire country or even the world knows about this girl at Columbia University who's carrying a mattress around to protest, you know, the treatment of her sexual assault,
yeah,
by the university. I mean, you know, she – had such a smart idea. Like, Hillary Clinton even said, like, that image of her carrying her mattress around should haunt us all. She went to Obama's State of the Union address as a guest of Kirsten Gillibrand, the senator from New York. You know, she was in the papers constantly, and she was hailed as this wonderful heroine, right? And Columbia was really tarred as an uncaring, corrupt institution. So you know, this kind of goes back to your first question, which is like, was she just an uncomplicated heroine dealing with a completely corrupt institution? You know, as I began to report, I learned that the truth was more complicated than right. that. You know, the truth about her case and, you know, many people kind of were shocked when the boy involved in the case decided to release a bunch of text messages that had happened between them both before and after this incident. And Paul, his name, he, you know, really wanted people to see her as kind of a vengeful ex-fling and somebody who was doing this out of spite and malice and who was, like, very cloying and was somebody who was just unstable and liked him so much and couldn't deal with him kind of spurning her. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in truth, the text messages are a bit more complicated to parse than that. While I do think she said some things that make her not look like a perfect victim, she also, you know, did do what a lot of victims do, which is after the incident, they think, oh, well, I should just talk to this guy and maybe we could just talk about it and he could understand that I'm upset. And that's how you get closure and move on. And she explained some of the messages where she was trying to get him to meet her, not as evidence like, oh, you're trying to hang out with your rapist, but more like I was trying to talk to him to see if we could resolve this. And of course, I'm going to do it in like a cute, flirtatious way because that's how people do things on text messages. So some of that was true. You know, the fact is that, you know, her case, like many other cases, it's complicated because there's not a lot of physical evidence. She didn't make the report till much later. In some ways, you know, it is a he said, she said. You know, when you talk to experts, they don't want to say this on the record. But off the record, they'll say the problem with date rape, the problem with rape that's not about a stranger holding a gun to somebody's head – is that, you know, rape kits don't always work so great. They're really great at picking up DNA from a stranger, but we know who was there.
Yeah.
And the he said, she said problem in date rape, which is what this is, you know, the term that we now use, the term acquaintance rape, mm-hmm. to kind of take the romance out of, you know, what is not a romantic situation. It does come down to a he said, she said so much of the time. It does come down to this issue of the guy saying, but I had consent. I had consent. And how does the girl prove that she didn't give consent?
Right.
It's very complicated.
Well, that whole story is complicated mm-hmm. because there were, according to the story, we don't have to get too much into it, but there were two acts of consent, two sexual mm-hmm. Experiences that they had that were consensual. She disputed whether the third, which was anal sex, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. was consensual. So it just – it's incredibly complicated, it seems.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I mean, you know, the fact is most people in America would say once you've gotten in bed with the person, you know, well, really? Does that mean rape after that? I mean, you've already had intercourse.
Yeah.
Is that really rape, the second act of intercourse? I mean, there's lots of guys that I interviewed for this book who said, you know, if there's not a weapon used or some sort of like extreme force with fists, I wouldn't call it sexual assault. Like, oh, that girl down the street who got raped by a guy who came in through her window, that's rape.
Yeah.
You know, this other stuff, this loosey-goosey who's got consent, who doesn't, you know, come on. It's ridiculous. So, you know, we are really all at like very far off edges of the room here.
Yeah, yeah,
again,
yeah, yeah.
The definitions are really critical.
I wanted to get at this new context that we're operating in, where on one hand, you talk about you have college campuses being this front line for sex positive feminism. And then on the other hand, it's still, you say, in many ways, and there are a lot of institutions within the institution that are, as you call, bastions of traditional masculinity. And those things mixing together make it pretty, I don't know, original, unique. It's mm-hmm. a really interesting context.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I mean, the modern campus is a totally strange, otherworldly place. You know, you have, you know, really across the country. And again, my book focuses on four-year residential yeah. universities, the kinds that have sports teams, maybe, you know, Big Ten or just big football teams, the kind that have a Greek system, you know, and also like kind of extraordinary, enormous dorms that are being built across the country to, you know, $700 million spent on like this, you know, 10,000 people or 1,000 people are going to be in this dorm. Like, the, you know, the dorms keep on getting bigger and bigger and bigger, creating these this kind of housing that I don't think is particularly safe because you've got a lot of women who are living there with their guards down because they think, oh, everybody in this dorm is a friend, when really it's just a bunch of strangers living in apartments together, you know, which is kind of a key thing that is a problem in sexual assault is, you know, being too trusting, honestly, being kind of naive about the guy who kind of, you know, comes into your dorm room at midnight and says, oh, hey, like, can I, you know, borrow like a pen or something, and kind of will try to seduce you into conversation and then something else from there. So I focused on those places and the kind of traditional masculinity of the, you know, the football teams and
the Greek system.
The yeah. Greek system and the fraternities, because like one in six American men now belongs to a fraternity, which is a kind of stunning amount.
Yeah.
And at the same time, you know, the universities are also experiencing the biggest upswing in radical activism since basically 1969, you know, 1970s.
Yeah.
So what is going on here?
Yeah.
We have, again, two sides that are so far from each other. You know, the progressive students on campus are not just – now they're not just like one floor in one dorm. You know, they're one corner of campus.
Yeah.
Even, you know, the schools that are very, very traditional have a – like a growing number of students who believe in, you know, pretty hard left ideas. And a lot of those left ideas are not just like pro-DACA, anti-Trump, you know, pro-Black Lives Matter, whatever the kind of constellation is. They're also about supporting victims, supporting rape victims, and kind of broadening this definition of sexual assault to include things that previous generations wouldn't have called sexual assault. And well, why do they, you know, have like an ideological leg to stand on there? Well, you know, A, it's the ethical thing that I said. And, you know, a lot of students today are really, you know, people think because of the internet, they've all become very empathetic, right? Because they've kind of grown up being exposed to so many different kinds of people. That's why socially, you know, a lot of the surveys are showing that they feel much more liberal on a lot of social issues than their parents. You know, the important part of them broadening to the definition and why the universities need to get involved is because it is an educational issue. You don't want students to experience sexual assault and the aftermath of sexual assault and then drop out of school because they're so depressed and they feel really traumatized by this. You know, everybody needs to have an equal education. So that's also part of the thinking of why the universities really need to make sure that this, you know, kind of winds down on their campuses.
Yeah. You point out today's college students aren't actually having more sex or more sexual partners than in previous decades, but that they have sex differently. It's a more kind of casual experience than it used to be. Talk a little bit about that, if you would, because this seemed a critical point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, I mentioned before the kind of hookup and the one-night stand. You know, there certainly are relationships that happen on campus or, you know, kind of dating relationships. But they initial hookup, the initial sexual contact, whether, you know, and hookup is kissing or, you know, second base, third base, you know, sex, it's could be anything. That is really happening in a kind of like scattershot, unfocused way. It's not I'm picking you up at your dorm at 7 p.m. with a flower and I'm going to take you to a restaurant and then we're going to see a movie. You know, that's not the kind of dating that's going on. It's just like very random, like, mm-hmm. oh, texting, like, what's up? This idea of, you know, this phrase Netflix and chill is like, oh, you could come over to my dorm room and we could watch some Netflix and chill, which is kind of code for like, we're going to hook up, yeah. you know? I mean, this is a, you know, again, a complicated topic with a lot of paradox in it. The studies are certainly showing that, like, college students are not having as much sex as they used to, and yet they are still feeling violated by a lot of those early sexual experiences. So they're still reporting pretty high rates of sexual assault.
Right.
So I think that the conclusion we can draw from this is that these sexual experiences that they're having, these hookup experiences, are not great, you know?
Yeah.
They're either
yeah.
bad or they're crossing into non-consensual sex. People are leaving those experiences feeling violated. And, you know, I don't want to be puritanical about it. I don't want to say like, oh, well, you know, that means that they just shouldn't have sex, you
yeah.
know? We should be realistic. But again, we have to foster a sense of ethical sex within our students, thoughtfulness for the other person. This is not just an object. This is a human being here.
Yeah.
And get them to, you know, figure out a way to respect each other more. It really comes down to respect.
Vanessa Gregoriadis, her book is called Blurred Lines. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Support for this Radio West podcast comes from Salt Lake County Animal Services, a no-kill municipal shelter specializing in pet adoptions, licensing, humane education, and more. Located at 511 West, 3900 South in Salt Lake City. More information is at AdoptUtahPets.com.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the journalist Vanessa Gregoriadis. We're talking about her book, Blurred Lines, Rethinking Sex, Power, and Consent on Campus. You're clear that you were inspired by Emma and some of her peers, but also you make the point that some of the finer points of their, as you put it, their ideology and their tactics have raised some legitimate questions. Like whether or not sometimes they make it sound as if all sexual assault is extremely violent or all mm-hmm. sexual assault on campus is perpetrated by this small group of serial predators, which you work through in mm-hmm. the book, mm-hmm. which is kind of an overstatement. And I just you write in the introduction about how difficult it was for you to admit or to write about how there are times when these stories could be a little overstated sometimes or over-exaggerated mm-hmm. or misunderstood. I wanted you to just talk about that, if you will.
Yeah. I mean, I say in the book, you know, that I felt sometimes like I was on a reality show, you know, that there was like a little bit of truth to every story, but there were so many layers of misperceptions and the perceptions of one's friends and peers on top of that, that I couldn't really tell the fact from the fiction.
Right.
You know, I should make clear this is not like, you know, the vast majority of the stories that I heard, but, you know, there's certainly like – look, it's hard because as, you know, a woman who wrote a book about sexual assault, you know, the last thing I want people to come away with is that some of these stories are hard to believe.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But at the same time, as a journalist, I have to be honest about what I saw and what I heard and what I learned from these students. And what I learned is that, you know, a lot of the disagreements between some of the more radical left students and the guys that they were accusing were about acts that I personally would not have necessarily called assault.
Right.
You know, they were about sex that was really maybe unpleasant, but not in the area where the boys should actually be thrown out of school and punished in that way, because that is severe. You know, it is – when you're thrown out of school, you are totally humiliated in front of your family. You know, if you have a scholarship, you're probably going to lose it. If you get a notation on your transcript of sexual misconduct, you know, no other school of any tier really wants you. You know, you're going to go to community college or, you know, see if you can figure something else out.
Yeah.
That may follow you if you want to go to med school or law school, mm-hmm. you know. In this country, as soon as we put sexual in front of something like misconduct, people flip out,
yeah.
you know, even if the actual act was pretty low level. So my take on the way to think about this is, again, that we are in this kind of transition of definitions,
right.
and that young women are saying, this is my body. I want to be treated more respectfully. If I have to call it assault to get us there, I will.
Right.
You know, so it's kind of a transitional time, and there's some boys who are being caught in that time of transition. And, you know, we have to be honest about that, and we have to figure out a way to deal with those guys. And I think that there should be kind of lower level disciplinary actions that don't involve expulsion or even suspension for some of this stuff, because, you know, it doesn't work. Like, punishing those guys really severely just sends them home to their mom's basements to get on internet sites and talk about how they hate women. Like, it doesn't actually work.
Right.
So, you know, we have a goal here, which is to change the sexual standard for this generation, and let's figure out how to get to that goal and not create, you know, so many enemies along the way
yeah.
that we're actually kind of shooting ourselves in the foot, collective feet.
Yeah. You write this in the book, that if boys are being punished unfairly for minor offenses, then how can we reconcile this injustice with the greater good of banishing sexual assault from universities?
Mm-hmm.
Like that's the bigger idea. And you talk with – you mentioned meeting a group of mothers of young men accused of sexual assault. You talked with some of those who have accused offenders. I guess it raised the question of who are they? Because there's this impression that there are just a few serial predators out there. That is one of the impressions that's out there. And it seems like it's kind of a myth that you at least deal with in the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I had a mom of an accused boy from South Carolina. And, you know, she was like, I mean, she was a conservative mom. She was like a firecracker. She was very cool and funny, and you know, she was willing to have her son talk to me because her son wanted to go into politics, and he'd been expelled from Auburn University, and he said, you know, she kind of said, like, well, son, you know, if you want to go into politics, you better talk about this experience that you had, you know, put it out there publicly, wear it like a three-piece suit, wear it like a seersucker suit with a bow tie.
Right.
And, you know, their perspective was like, you know, she was like, my son, you know, this was – did he use his best judgment on the night in question? No.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a big difference between acting without judgment at 19 and being a criminal with intent to harm.
Yeah.
And I think that's true. Intent really matters here, you know. That's the core, is that there are guys who are rehabilitatable, who are probably, you know, this is probably even a bigger group than the dyed-in-wool predators. And I will admit that, like, a college campus, you know, I said it's a nice place for a journalist to operate. Well, it's a real nice place for a predator to operate,
yeah.
too,
yeah,
you know.
True.
part of why we have these high numbers is, like, you know, the guy down the dorm who is like the secret Harvey Weinstein is able to go out night after night and go to frat parties and kind of act under like a kind of, you know, a like with a mask on, basically, right, of a friendly college student. And that definitely, you know, exists, and they have a lot of opportunity there, right? And crime is always linked to opportunity. But, you know, this other group of guys, we need to figure out how to reach them,
yeah,
and make sure that they use better judgment, basically.
You know,
if their intent was not to harm, they must learn how to use better judgment.
Well, and you also refer to this hopefully new research that may or may not be coming that may give us a sense of just how strongly young men in college are being affected by social norms. Like, it doesn't seem like we know much yet, but you gave some sense that maybe we are going to come to understand that better.
Sure. I mean, I think that you know, what experts are hoping to have happen is that they can figure out a way to reach those guys. Again, that's like, you know, the cohort of guys who are using bad judgment but don't have the intent, right? Nobody thinks you can reach guys who are dyed-in-wool predators. That's kind of, you know, those guys kind of walk among us in all areas,
yeah,
you know, in our life. So, you know, that's just part of being a human on this earth. We have to, you know, we don't know how to fix that problem, those guys. But these other guys, I think, you know, the experts want to figure out, well, what is the education that we can deliver? And they call their seminars that they give to college students doses. You know, how do we administer a dose that changes this boy's attitudes? And they're starting to figure out how to change the attitudes, but they haven't seen much of a change in perpetration.
Yeah.
From there. And the hope is, though, is that more and more attitudes, as they change, and we can see right now that we're in this moment where, you know, everybody across the country is talking about what's going on in Hollywood with sexual harassment, what happened at Fox News with sexual harassment, mm-hmm, you know, Bill Cosby. Like, you know, college guys are thinking to themselves, like, I don't want to be one of those guys. You know, I don't want to be ostracized. I don't want to be the guy who girls look at as a bad guy. And in fact, if I'm a guy who says, like, I sympathize with survivors, maybe, like, girls will like me more.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
maybe that means actually I'm a real good guy. And they actually, you know, girls find that to be an appealing quality.
Yeah. Social currency on a campus.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly, exactly. So I think that is starting to shift. But, you know, obviously there's, you know, it's slow. Social change is always kind of slow, and there'll be, you know, a couple steps forward and a couple steps back.
Yeah.
And, you know, we all hope that the stuff that's going on right now in Hollywood is not just like, okay, let's cast out these 40 guys and then just go back to you know, status quo, but yeah, real change.
There are some recommendations you make at the end of the book in this appendix. And I wanted to go through some of these because I thought recommendations that you make for students themselves, their parents. One of them is move the drinking age to 18. Mention that because this is such a pragmatic kind of practical suggestion. And it really deals with the issue of I'm not sure if there's a type who gets assaulted, but certainly those who are particularly vulnerable are those who are first coming to college, freshmen.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So we know that the first, like, 6 weeks of college, which are called the red zone by sociologists, are the most dangerous for particularly freshman women who come to campus. And, like, why is that? Okay, they are going to be exposed to drinking, and they've probably not had a lot of drinking experience in the past. They're also not being invited to the upperclassmen's cool off-campus apartment with the awesome band, you know, and all the political science majors, right? They're being invited to the fraternities. That's where the parties are at the beginning. So, you know, this kind of thing that happens every August or September. The girls all get dressed up together on one dorm room floor, and they all go out in a little herd, and you can kind of see these girls walking across the campus as they go, you know, in thinking that they're safe because they're all together. But of course, they're entering a fairly unsafe environment because the, you know, the goal of the frat party is YOLO. You only live once. It's like, okay, let's just get as, you know, drunk as possible and do some crazy stuff because that's what college is about. And so I think that the binge drinking culture on campus is inextricably woven with the sexual assault problem. Yeah. And it's woven in two ways. And the first is that, you know, guys, those kinds of predator types, will ply girls with alcohol to make them more pliable, right? We all know that this happens. And the second problem is that, you know, binge drinking for girls is way up over the last decade, not showing signs of falling. And it's created a situation where girls are getting so drunk that they're not in control. Yeah. And that is not cool. Like, that's on a pragmatic level, just common sense says that you have to have control of your facilities if you want to, you know, avoid bad situations. Like, otherwise, you're just turning yourself into kind of a lifeless object. And, like, who knows what will happen from there? You know, these kind of, like, girls who are, like, passing out on a futon at a frat party at the end of the night are in a totally unsafe situation. And I'm not blaming them. That's not about blaming the victims. It's just about saying, like, you know, you need to be smart about your risk. Every individual, you know, bears some responsibility for managing his or her own risk. That's why people lock their doors to their houses, you know. They wear winter coats outside when it's winter. Like, those things are important, and I think that drinking's part of that. In terms of bringing down the drinking age, like, I just think this experiment of raising the drinking age really hasn't worked.
Yeah.
And
do you want to mention, you know, the Dartmouth model too?
Mm-hmm. Sure. So, you know, Dartmouth, which had a lot of problems with hazing and with sexual assault, decided to completely reconstitute their campus in New Hampshire. So, you know, they took this incredibly seriously. They have a very, very, very strong Greek system there. The, you know, some absurd amount of students belong to compared to, like, it's like, you know, it's a small campus, but everybody's Greek.
Yeah.
And they decided to not only completely ban hard liquor from the campus. I'm not even sure you can buy a bottle of whiskey in that town anymore. You know, I was speaking to a student the other day who was at Dartmouth who told me that the students were now smuggling in whiskey in shampoo bottles because they were so fearful of being stopped with, you know, alcoholic containers. So they also created a new style of dorm that isn't those enormous, you know, 1,000+ students in a lot of state universities that state universities are really building right now because, you know, they're financially pretty lucrative, right? You can really charge a lot for a dorm room. But what Dartmouth has done is they've made the dorms much smaller, and they have put not only an adult in there to kind of oversee things, but they've created a really lovely common space in all of the dorms and provided funds for the students to bring in different speakers or bands or put on plays or just anything to keep the social life away from the fraternities.
Later in the book, you mentioned having a kind of a subjective viewpoint for the book and in a lot of your writing. And later in the book, you say that having reported the story made you rethink some college sexual episodes in your life. Do you mind saying in what way?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that, you know, I don't consider myself to be a victim of sexual assault. And even after writing this book, I don't consider that.
Yeah.
You know, I feel that, you know, I I went to a school that didn't really have frats. And I want to make clear, like, I'm not saying all frats are bad. Yeah. I'm just thinking in, like, a more kind of abstract level of fixing this problem. Maybe we could have, like, you know, co-ed fraternities or something like that. But, you know, I realized that even in my, like, little progressive bubble in the school that I went to in Connecticut, some of those early sexual experiences that I had were really disturbing and really kind of laid the, you know, I guess psychological groundwork, I should say, for who I would ultimately become as an adult in terms of my sexual identity. And, you know, that was a kind of painful experience to rethink things that I had seriously just blotted out of my out of my mind. And, you know, I'm not also not saying, like, I acted in such a stand-up fashion to some guys either. You know, they're not the specific ones that I felt were, like, kind of crossing the line. But, you know, I think that I could have benefited from some rules and some boundaries around, okay, well, if this guy doesn't like you, you know, let it go, right? You don't need to obsess over it. You don't need to flirt with him at every party. You know, you kind of need to have more, like, respect for what other people want than I had when I was in college, too.
Yeah. Let me ask you this finally. Do you... One of the things it seems like you get at is there needs to be a cultural change to really deal with all of this. Do you feel hopeful after having reported this for, you know, more than, you know, 3+ years? Do you feel hopeful that the culture will figure this out and we can deal with this in some way?
Oh, I do feel very hopeful. Yeah. And it's a very optimistic book, actually. Yeah. You know, not only with, like, okay, here's the things that, like, parents need to know to keep, like, you know, their girls and boys from being assaulted and also boys being accused of sexual assault, like, here are the actual tips. But also, you know, I look forward to seeing what young people are going to do and how they're planning to change the world, because they're doing it right now. This is the most engaged moment for college students in many, many years. And the fact that they're thinking through these complicated topics, like, what is sexual consent really, you know? What is, you know, what should I feel empathetically for somebody who confesses an assault to me? Should I, you know, kind of spurn and ostracize that person because it's going to be complicated for our clique if she talks about this? Or should I really emotionally support her because it's the right thing to do? Like, their emphasis on what the right thing to do is, I think, is really extraordinary. And I think we need to, you know, kind of say, okay, well, you know, sometimes they're kids and they overdetermine things and they see the world in very black and white. And there is gray in there. But the general way that they're taking things on this issue particularly, and I think in the country in general, is pretty great.
That's Vanessa Gregoriadis. Her book is Blurred Lines, Rethinking Sex, Power, and Consent on Campus. She joined us from a studio in New York City. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Michael Havey. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio. ¶¶